figure that out. Go figure that out. Lesson, never randomly scroll your emails before the show roll. Hey, everybody, it is Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. Me and Molly Wood, this is the Tuesday big show, tech, the economy, culture, all that good stuff. Not so good today, actually, because we're going to talk about the news and what is in the news and what has been on televisions and on the radio and in newspapers and podcasts and all of that the last, like, 6 days now, right, Molly? 6 days, something like
seven.
That?
Seven. Yeah, seven days. Seven. Yeah. I mean, we have talked about this in the context of the pandemic and the protests at the same time. When this pandemic first started, of course, you know, there was this sense of, like, we're all in this together. It really quickly became clear that that is not true. If anything, it is revealing all of the ways that inequality still exists in this country. And in fact, communities of color are suffering disproportionately. And then, of course, on top of that, again, you had a black man killed by police officers. And that is, you know, in a very, very, very small nutshell, how we get there to how we get to now. Peaceful and not so peaceful protests in 140 cities, gatherings around the world. People are really at a breaking point.
So what we're going to do is we're going to get some input, some expert input, as we do on now what, I guess. D'Artagnan Scorza is the founder and executive director of the Social Justice Learning Institute. It's out in Inglewood, Los Angeles, which is actually where he grew up. D'Artagnan, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you, first of all, what your gut reaction was when you first heard about George Floyd, just to sort of set a timing parameter here.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll tell you that as a black man who leads an organization supporting the growth and development of black male youth, and as a father of a young black boy, I was anguished and I was enraged. And for me, feeling beyond tired and fed up with these cycles of police violence and the promise for change.
Hmm. Tell us about what you do.
So I run an organization that supports community members, especially young black males, so that they can help exit the juvenile justice system and enter into pathways of opportunity through college and or the workforce. Many young folk who utilize research to create change in their communities. And so I think it's in the context of that, and that comes from my own personal experience having grown up here in Los Angeles and having lived through the 1992 LA uprisings, and realizing how we needed to build leaders who could come back to improve conditions in their own community and address issues related to inequality.
Mm-hmm. There's so many ways this conversation could go, and obviously podcasts can go forever, but we can't really go forever. But I do want to sidetrack for 2 seconds and ask about language. The 92 uprisings is what you call them. I've heard the current actions being called rebellions, protests, looting. Words matter, especially and probably more now in this context, right?
I think that's right. And in many ways, you know, I call them the 92 LA uprisings because they reflect an experience that I had when I was 12 years old in the streets of South Los Angeles, living through the verdict that came down after the Rodney King beatings, right? I remember sitting in the house with my family being unclear about what was happening. And I remember people being very, very upset about the verdict and feeling like justice had not been served. And so folk took to the streets because they believed the justice system had failed them. Their voices were not being heard and they wanted to be heard. And as we've heard Dr. King say, right, riots are the language of those who are unheard. Mm-hmm. And for me, mm-hmm. in many ways, it's a reflection of centuries old racism and oppression that has been manifested in these moments today.
Yeah. What is the job of everyone? I mean, I think some of the frustrations, some of the conversations we've been having, I'm in Oakland, and one of the things we've commented on is how Oakland just has a strategy at this point. It's like the city goes, okay, well, you know, now there are going to be protests. We're going to do this. We're going to, and that creates this despair, this sense that this just keeps happening. You know, how do we move forward? How do we make real change?
So I appreciate you asking that question because I know for me and for many of the young folks, so we got a group of our students together on Sunday. About 40 of our young folks showed up to a a Zoom call, and we talked about that very issue. And one of the things that was abundantly clear is that we're tired of using the same words that we've used in the past to help make meaning of what's happening right now. We're tired of saying we need change, reform the system, we need review boards, we need all of that. What our young folk have really said is that they need to be able to live with the dignity of their lives uninhibited. And not only the need to live, but the right to jog in peace, the right to sit in their homes in peace, the right to breathe in peace. And when we took a step back and began to talk about what needs to happen in this moment, they said, we need to organize, right? We need to get out there and change these systems. We need to rethink what policing in our communities look like. We need economic opportunity so that we can thrive and live a good life. We need to advocate to those who are in power and change the law to restrict the use of force that police or individual officers may be able to use when they make a decision, right? We need to change our local cities and municipal codes. We need independent monitoring oversight. You know, they're really wise, right? These are young folk, 14, 15. These are young folk who understand the conditions they're living in. And they recognize that these conditions have been historical.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. You were talking about the young folk and how they had actual ideas, because I'm sure you saw the thread from Obama within the past day or so, a long thing on what we should do and what has to happen. And Obama says, you know, changing the federal government is important, but the elected officials who matter most work at the state and local levels. We need to be specific in our demands for criminal justice and police reform. So sitting where you sit and being who you are, what are those specific changes that you think we need?
I think we need to reimagine what policing looks like. You know, I have colleagues that argue for the abolition of police stations. I'm not certain that we need to abolish police in that regard. I do think, however, we need to reimagine what protection in our communities look like. How do we transition? We need to ask ourselves, how do we transition to community protection strategies where folk in the cities themselves are sort of the first line of defense? We need to think about how much money we invest in police departments and demilitarize police, right? I'm a U.S. Navy Iraq War veteran. I served in the military. I was on ground in Baghdad. I can tell you that some of the sounds that I hear in my neighborhood or heard around town as I've driven through remind me of what it felt like to be in Baghdad. And that's not okay. We are on American soil. And when we have leadership in our country calling for domination, calling for the shutting down of, in some cases, peaceful protests, that's a problem. Specifically, we need better leadership in this moment. We need leadership that unifies people. And we need to ensure that the voices of those who have not been heard is actually being heard.
Yeah. You have described a lot of work being done within the Black and Brown community. Like you have said, these young men that I'm working with feel that they have to do that work. But they're not the only ones who should have to do that work. I think like Kai and I are acutely aware of the unfairness of even asking you what should be done when what really should be done is us, right? Like when you look around LA this week, this weekend, do you see enough white people out there?
You know, I see a lot of allyship. I also see a lot of challenges. It's really interesting because there's a lot not only happening on social media, where I think we're seeing both white, Asian, multiracial communities coming together to help stand peacefully in protest. But we're also seeing and hearing reports of folk that are coming out deliberately to vandalize and hijack the movement that I think those who are fighting for liberty and fighting for freedom have attempted to pursue. And so it's an interesting dynamic. What I will say, though, is that at the end of the day, and you've heard this repeatedly, we have to address this virus of racism. And in the midst of COVID-19, and you said it at the top of the program, right, we've been dealing with inequality and social inequality and economic inequality and health disparities for ages. When you look at W.E.B. Du Bois and what he wrote about the Philadelphia Negro back in the early 20th century, you know, he talked about very similar conditions. These conditions have existed for centuries. And what we're seeing in this moment, what makes this moment feel so different, is that I think people are just fed up and they don't feel like there's an avenue in our democracy to make them better. But what we need folk like you and Kai to do is to ensure that we are changing the law and that we are addressing these issues related to both race, but also racial inequality in our society.
Do you think, given where we are in this moment with 10 weeks of quarantine, deeply, deeply divided body politic, and the George Floyd killing meeting in a singularity, if I could mix my metaphors here, do you think this is a moment of opportunity for change in these key issues that you've been working for your whole life?
I think it has to be a moment and an opportunity for change. I think back to what happened shortly after the Civil War in 1862 and in 1865 with the Freedmen's Bureau. I think about 1921 and what happened with the Tulsa Race Massacre. I think about 1933 and the Federal New Deal programs. I think about all these moments in history when America had an opportunity to do something different, and instead it put policies in place that actually set us back, right? Even with Federal New Deal programs and the creation of the Federal Housing Administration, right? When we have these larger department and agencies that were created, they were created and then they built in and baked in inequality into their manuals, into their books, into their procedures, into their processes, right, into their rules. I think we have an opportunity now to do things differently. We can learn from history. We can look at these examples and say, okay, this is what we did in these moments of despair. We tried to rise to the occasion, but we did it for a certain group of people. We didn't do it for all. This time, let's do it differently. Let's look at how, as a people, as a society, as a federal government, with our state and local governments, how we can build institutions that create equality for all. How we can ensure that Black folk get access to loans when they want to be farmers and they're not losing their land. How we can address issues related to health in our society. How we can make sure everyone gets testing in this moment. We have an opportunity to rise to the occasion because I do believe America is a great place, right? I would not have put my life on the line had I not believed that and believed that this was my home. It was a place worth fighting for, is a place worth valuing, right? I would not believe that if I didn't go to UCLA and get my PhD and come back to my community to serve, if I didn't believe that this country had the promise of being great. And I think that's what these protests represent. It's the frustration that we all want to achieve greatness for ourselves and our communities, but so many of us are unable to do so.
I want to talk about COVID for a minute because I know that you have also been organizing events for COVID-19 relief, and I wonder how much the unequal distribution of the virus itself is making these inequalities really unavoidable, I think, to people who have tried to rationalize them away before.
You know, I think what we're seeing in our community, and you're right, we just organized in the past week a food distribution event for 3,000 families. And we organize one every single week for 250 to 400 families. And we continue to expand and provide access to food. What we have seen is that all it did was expose what we already knew to be the case, right? We were dealing with housing issues and homelessness issues, specifically for African-American and Black and brown families here in Los Angeles, dealing with displacement issues. And all COVID-19 did was in many ways fully expose it. It removed some of the compensatory factors like schools, right? Schools are compensatory institutions. They help address issues with inequality. When a family is not able to afford food, right? A child goes to school and they get two, sometimes three meals a day plus snacks. That compensates for social inequality. When they have mental health needs, right? They go to a school and they get a behavioral health counselor. That compensates for the inequality that already exists in our communities. So when schools shut down and when our institute and our Department of Social Services shut down and these institutions shut down, we no longer had these compensatory institutions doing the work to address inequality. And all it did was expose what was already there. This is nothing new. And I think, you know, when you see the death of George Floyd in this moment, as people are sitting in their house dealing with the effects of this virus, dealing with the fact that they know people in their families that have been exposed and are dying, and they're dealing with the trauma of that, and they can't go to the funerals, and they can't, you know, go see them. My cousin unfortunately passed during the shutdown, and we could not hold a funeral for him. So I know what that feels like in this moment, right? When they're seeing all of this, And then they see this black man who was allegedly trying to use a counterfeit $20 bill to buy products from a store because he lost his job in the midst of this pandemic. You're talking about unfairness piled on top of unfairness, piled on top of unfairness. And then he loses his life, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing to compensate for that. What are the compensatory factors in place to compensate for any black person in this society when it comes to police and policing? How do we ensure we don't lose our lives when we are sitting in our homes in Dallas and some officer comes and busts through the door thinking it's their house? Or with Breonna Taylor, they assume that there's a criminal in her house and she's an EMT. She's a hero on the front line. How do you compensate for that?
Yeah, well, the answer is you don't.
You keep working.
D'Artagnan Scorza, he is the founder and the executive director of the Social Justice Learning Institute in Inglewood, where he's from, here in the city of Los Angeles. D'Artagnan, thanks. We appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Take good care.
So, we're going to take a break, but hook us up, would you? Write to us, makemesmartmarketplace.org. Emails, voicemails, take your pick. We'll take anything. Let us know what you think about this moment. Let us know if you are hopeful about change. If you're not, why not? Why are you so?
What you're doing.
Let us know. makemesmartmarketplace.org.
Yeah. Keep it coming. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right, we're back.
All right.
We are back. Backity back, back, back. Okay, what do you want to do? You want me or you want you?
I think this is relevant. I'm going to jump in here. I think you can hear in our voices and D'Artagnan's voices and the fact that these protests are spreading all around the world that there's a feeling that this almost has to be a moment of real change. And yet there are so many headwinds, one of which is apparently Facebook. And the reason I say Facebook is because it's a place where a lot, literally billions of people get information and news, right? 2 billion people use this site. I mean, their metrics are a little dicey, but nevertheless, hundreds of millions of people get the bulk of their information and news from Facebook. Civil rights leaders met with Mark Zuckerberg yesterday. I think Cecilia Kang on Twitter put it best. She's a New York Times tech policy writer, and she said that these civil rights leaders went in with low expectations and were not disappointed. They came away from this meeting saying that Mark Zuckerberg gave, quote, incomprehensible explanations for not taking action against President Trump's looting and shooting post. They said he seemed to just not have really any understanding of so many of the issues that affect the communities of color that we're just talking about, voter suppression, right? How Violent speech leads to violence in the real world, whether it comes from President Trump or anyone else. And really, unfortunately, came away saying this massive platform for information, which, by the way, employees at Facebook are publicly protesting about themselves.
Yeah. And quitting, by the way. They've started quitting last night, this morning. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Kai's more up on the tech news than I am today,
So here's one. It's a software engineer. He says, I cannot stand by Facebook's continued refusal to act on the president's bigoted messages aimed at radicalizing the American public. I'm watching my company do nothing.
And this is these are the structural inequalities that we keep talking about, right?
Yeah.
When Facebook is in a position to literally have a self-serve ad system in which people selling houses can say, please don't show these listings to black people. Like, it is a big hill. And if they're having meetings with Zuckerberg in the midst of what is happening now globally, and he's like, I don't really get it, that's not a good start. That's not a good feeling.
Well, okay. So look, I'm glad you used that phrase, because I was going to coin a question and I wasn't sure how to broach it. Have you ever interviewed him or spoken to him?
No.
I have not. Okay. So we'll do a little opining here. Do you think he gets it? That's a serious question.
I mean, look, he is what, in his early 30s?
Yeah.
He's an early 30s something white guy who had a privileged upbringing and education. Facebook has, like, I think less than 2% black employees. Like, you and I don't get it. Our lived experiences right. will never right. allow right. us, right, to really right. understand yeah. what D'Artagnan is saying. Like, we right. can intellectually empathize all we want. We will not get it because we are white people. And Mark Zuckerberg is like white person times a bajillion. And then on top of that, he's like bought up all the houses around him. You know, there are all these studies that say, like, the richer you get, the lower your empathy is, because your lived experience mm-hmm. is nothing like the people you see on the news. So, like, honestly, I don't think he gets it. And he's making a lot of money not getting it. And that's what you always say, right? Which is like getting people to give up their power and their money is
right.
the hardest part.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So let's see. Molly was talking about a 30-something white guy whose lived experience does not let him appreciate the reality of what's going on the streets of a lot of cities of America today. My news item is a Twitter thread from Casey Hunt. She works at NBC. Covers Capitol Hill, and she had a 6-tweet thread this morning where she asked Republican members of Congress what they thought about the president using force on peaceful protesters last night to get them out of the way so that he could walk from the White House over to St. John's Episcopal Church, the Church of the Presidents, right across Lafayette Park. And here's what they said. I'm just going to read these tweets. Senator Ron Johnson, R. Wisconsin, on the president's photo op. Quote, didn't really see it. Senator Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia, does not respond. Pat Roberts, Republican of Kansas, I don't have any comment on that. Rick Scott, Republican of Florida, does not stop to talk. Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, I didn't watch it closely enough to know. Senator Mike Enzi, Republican of Wyoming, sorry, I'm just reading this for the first time. Sorry, I'm late for lunch. And then Senator Marsha Blackburn, Republican of Tennessee, walks by without saying anything. Look, let's keep going. Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska.
Two of them said they were late for lunch.
Yeah, well, but Murkowski... Well, you know, hang on. Murkowski said, what we saw last night was not the America that I know, just to give some Republicans their due who are members of the United States Senate. Anyway, first of all, that's just not credible. And second of all, come on, you guys.
Yeah.
That's it.
I mean, look, that's the whole ball game right there.
Yeah.
That thread is the whole ball game. All right, we're going to go ahead and let you guys talk for a while. Let's do the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, our first letter comes from listener Greg Witten. He's an I love that I just said letter. Aw. He's an economics professor currently living. I wish it was a letter.
Retro.
I wish I had like a little opener. He is an economics professor currently living in Hong Kong and wanted to weigh in on our conversation last week about what is going on with Hong Kong, China, and the U.S. and actually how businesses might fare. So he writes, first, Hong Kong's legal system, which is common law based, still wins out over the mainland's legal system, which is civil law based, even if you don't consider the possibility of communist dictatorial interference. Common law systems do a better job protecting investors on average and therefore are more conducive for economic growth than our civil law system. So that answers the question of why Hong Kong's better for business. Then he says, second, independent courts do matter. And even though non-Chinese businesses can operate in Shanghai and Shenzhen, Hong Kong still offers advantages for contract enforcement and arbitration of conflicts. Third, Witten writes, recall that the PRC, the People's Republic of China, is a dictatorship. A dictatorship that, like the empires that came before it, had difficulty keeping together a country whose ordinary citizens, until a couple of decades ago, could not be counted on to understand literally what their compatriots said. So different were regional languages and dialects. Also, he says, the south of China, meaning south of the Yangtze, has always been hard for Beijing to control.
Yeah.
On the ground.
And critical points there. Yeah, on the ground.
Yeah. Fascinating.
From that part of the world. Yeah, totally. Okay, so last week we talked to Mariel Segarra. We had a great conversation, I thought, with Mariel about retail and what's going on there, what businesses can, maybe should do to reopen while keeping us safe, tricky as that may be. Lots of you weighed in on this one. Here's something from Nina Bastian of Denver, Colorado.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I continue to be concerned by the practices that big chain grocery stores attempt to implement, but in reality are already not being enforced. Wearing masks, keeping 6 feet from others, and one-way aisles are examples of things listed on the sign at the front door, but easily ignored. I imagine this to be the case at other big retailers that begin reopening across the country. Anecdotally, I've found that smaller local stores have been more effective at implementing these measures. For example, a neighborhood grocer in uptown Denver has a rotating employee stationed at the door, limiting the number of people who enter, checking for masks, and offering gloves as an option. How can we, as consumers, hold big retailers accountable to enforcing these practices as necessary long-term solutions that make us feel safe? I'd also like to mention that I haven't yet found the words to politely ask a fellow store patron who creeps up behind me to get something from a shelf I'm standing in front of to please respect my space.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I've noticed this as well.
Yep, absolutely. Totally agreeing.
I will say those words are...
Step back.
Those words are, can you please back up? Yep. Can you please back up? I'm serious. Like, it is so, I mean, everybody wants to be so polite to each other. And the words are, can you please back up? Thank you.
Yeah. And they'll get it.
Go, right? Nina. Get it.
They'll get it.
I agree. I went to Home Depot 3 weeks ago. I mean, it was before like the mask regulations were really in place. Mm-hmm. And most of the people working there weren't wearing them. I will tell you, though, that like, if you want to hold them accountable, what you do is you turn around and leave. And I know this is not exactly an option in places where big box stores are really some are the only option. And that is the case in a lot of places. But I have at least one friend who's like, oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't go in there because I walked up to the door and people weren't wearing masks. And then send him a letter, and be like, this is why I didn't come in.
Right. It's my turn in the barrel in our house tonight to do the grocery store run, once every 2 weeks grocery store run. And I'm plotting out my moves, man. I'm like, all right, I have to go get pasta over here and then I have to go get cheese over there, you know? And I'm like, all right, how am I going to do this with least impact and most efficiency? Which is wandering around.
Oh yeah. No wandering. No, you gotta be efficient. Yeah. I have a friend who was like, he's like, oh, I'm back in the Whole Foods line. Cause I forgot something.
You forget something and you wait another 2 weeks.
Like, that's like, you can't forget something. Like, what are you thinking?
And if you do. It's your punishment. You have to wait 2 weeks. I'm sorry. No yogurts for you. You got to wait 2 weeks. Sorry, kiddo.
The local stores are the way to go, though. If you have them, they are the way to go because I don't understand if people are waiting in line at Trader Joe's for 2 hours. Like, sure, it's lovely.
Oh, I know.
Trader Joe's. That's a nice Trader Joe's is a nice benefit or a nice privilege. But like, I could not be less interested in Trader Joe's in pandemic time. Nope. Like, I can get what I need. Let's see. Now, for the perspective of an employee at a business trying to reopen, Amy, we're going to want to hear from you after this week, too, trying to reopen during all of the unrest that we're seeing, because I have seen businesses in Oakland just throw up their hands at this point. Amy Cassius works for a family-owned jewelry store in Indiana. They opened back up on May 4th, and she says, actually, business is banana pants right now. She writes, that's not a direct quote. I think some people just have adopted banana pants out in the world. I'm not sure it's Amy. But she says, we have already exceeded our sales goal for the month with still a few days to go. Mother's Day weekend was so busy that it was very similar to the Christmas holiday shopping season. I've been at this job for nearly 8 years, and I've never seen anything like this during May. Being a family-owned business with 70 stores across the Midwest region, we had much more flexibility in acquiring resources and ensuring, ding, 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 to Nina's point, new safety policies are in place. Mm-hmm. More flexibility than our big box jewelry store competitors, all of which are currently closed in our mall. Face masks are required for employees. We do have movable plexiglass partitions and sanitizing measures in use to show merchandise. She says, but I am still fearful that I'm being exposed to coronavirus due to the amount of cash transactions we've been taking in, which have increased dramatically. And the large numbers of shoppers without a face covering, 80% or greater. She says, Indiana recommends a face covering, but it's not mandatory. And at our mall, there's no requirement, nor can we implement an enforcement in our store. Thanks for this episode. You keep me smiling.
Wear a mask, wear a mask, wear a mask, wear a mask, wear a mask. It's not for you. It's for the 80-year-old grandmother you pass by, or it's for the kid who's 14 and has asthma and really doesn't know any better. Don't wear it for yourself. Wear it for everybody else. Come on, man.
I know, seriously. Sorry. Also, that dumb study, that one study that basically was like, they don't work very well, or they make it worse, or whatever, was retracted. I need to say this right now. That study was retracted. Retracted. By the way, to what I was saying at the beginning of this email, Amy actually did write back to us and say the jewelry store has closed all locations again because of the protests.
Which has got to be killing them. All these small businesses, big businesses too. I mean, it's like a 1-2 punch 14 times in a row, you know? Okay, so I personally spent part of my weekend watching that SpaceX launch, which was really cool. And that is the subject of the answer to the Make Me Smart question this week. Comes to us from Jen Billick. She's in Berkeley, California.
So this is embarrassingly recent. I was having a conversation about space exploration with my Aunt Sue, and she mentioned how difficult it is to simulate anti-gravity for astronaut training. And I said, what do you mean? They just use an anti-gravity machine. And she said, what? You've got to be kidding me. And I said, well, that's what they use. I've seen footage. And she said, gravity is one of the four fundamental forces of nature. If they figured out how to turn that off, it would be a change in scientific paradigm. The only way to simulate weightlessness is in a falling plane or one of those blower rooms. And as she said that, it hit me. Because I took physics in high school, where I learned that gravity was not just a good idea, it was the law. And we both just burst out laughing. I think that we laughed for, 20 minutes straight. So now I know that you can't turn off gravity yet.
Yet.
Oh, man, I love
anything
that.
Could happen in 2020. That is amazing.
This could be the year. This could be the year.
We gotta make more me smile out of it. I didn't see that coming.
Awesome. That is awesome.
That is amazing.
I love that.
That is it for our show today. Again, please email us. Please email us. There are, I don't know, so many important conversations happening right now. Don't forget to sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter. There's more conversation happening there, marketplace.org/newsletters. We'll be back tomorrow with What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. So now is a good time to ask us some important questions if you think we have the answers, or at least can Google them in time for the show. And our email address once more is makemesmart@marketplace.org. See you tomorrow.
Let us know how you're doing, too, because these are tough times.
Yeah.
Tough, tough times. They keep getting tough. It's just, it's weird. This year, man, you're like, whew.
It's literally like every worst case scenario happening simultaneously.
Yeah. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote. Ethan Parrott is the video intern. Writer-producer is Erica Phillips.
Drew Jostad engineered the program. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed the music. The executive director of On Demand's Attorney is the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, who I don't think would mind us talking through her part. I don't think she'd
be fine. She'd be fine.
Thanks. We're done.
Yep. Ben, I know I slacked you about this, but I want to make sure you see it. I forgot to start rolling until like 2 minutes in, so that's what's going on.
I knew it because I heard your GoPro start. Today's program is engineered by, he was trying to be all sneaky, and I heard this like, beep, beep. I'm like, oh, I know that sound.
Oh, man.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.